Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, grandmother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and emotion worker. She uses all of these skills to address the subjects we all struggle with in this conversation with a reluctant therapist. Good afternoon and happy Tuesday, Elizabeth.
Happy Tuesday, Hank. You sound like you have a date or something. You're trying to get out the door.
Well, it is lunchtime.
Okay, well, I'm glad you're excited about what comes next. It's a beautiful day for lunch. It's nice to be here this afternoon.
My car said it was 84 degrees this afternoon.
Well, it's, 64 in here, so it's all relative, actually. But it's fabulous to be able to gather every Tuesday and have these conversations and keep up with each other's lives. This week, we have a topic that's quite large and complex, which is one of my favorite ways to discuss life in large terms and with complexity. So I'm looking forward to hearing what you have to say about our topic. It's definitely not a Valentine's show. We did that last week. But in keeping with the idea of attachment and our brain center and how romantic love and passionate love sits in certain centers of our brain and actually imitate addiction, romantic love and passionate love become an addictive force in our bodies. This week, we're going to change it up just a little bit and talk about actual addiction, addiction to opiates, to be exact, and the epidemic that's occurring across the nation when it comes to opiate and heroin addiction and what we can do or what needs to be done to help curb this fastest rising addiction in the United States. And the thing that's so disturbing or distressing about the opiate addiction crisis is that it's not one of the main topics, or it's not even a topic in the debates or discussions in the national political scene right now. And it's interesting because when I was looking through information and research about this topic, one of the first things that came up was an article in the USA Today, talking about the heroin epidemic in New Hampshire, right where they're having the primary today, and talking about the quadrupled deaths that have happened over the last couple years and the lack of services and the fact that this addiction epidemic is not of the same population or demographics that we are used to or we think we know about from days gone by. Because heroin and opiate addiction is not new to our culture, but what's changed is how these drugs are being accessed and who is accessing the drugs. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. And if you'd like to be part of the conversation, we'll open up the phone lines in a bit. 805-781-3875 is the number to talk to us. But you can also participate by liking our Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist, our website, thereluctanttherapist.com, or you can send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. You can listen to previous shows at kcbx.org or with our new technology, you can podcast our shows by going to iTunes, The Reluctant Therapist, and you can subscribe and get all of our previous shows and keep up with the shows that are coming. So pass the word along and keep up with what's happening on the show. So today we are going to talk about opiate addiction, and it's not my primary expertise. So I'm fortunate to have a guest in the studio with me today who it is his primary area of expertise, Alex Dodd, who is the CEO of Aegis Treatment Centers, the largest treatment centers for opiate and heroin addiction in California or in the United States?
Just in California.
Over 100 communities are served right now with 15 different clinics.
We operate in 15 counties have 25 clinics. Thank you very much for having me on the show.
I'm happy to have you. You and I talked about this issue actually back in the fall, and you were so passionate about not just the treatment centers, but about the epidemic that's occurring across the country. And I thought I'd throw out, because I wanted to do some research so I'd know where we were today, a little research on what's happening. The New York Times said that 90% of first-time users of heroin are mainly middle-class white males that are wealthy. And they've seen a rise in the groups with historically low rates of heroin abuse, such as women, those with private insurance, and those with higher incomes. So I'll look forward to hearing more about that and why private insurance is connected. 75% of heroin addicts, 3 of 4 heroin addicts, began their addiction under utilizing prescription opiates, painkillers. That was their entry into heroin use. The other thing that I found fascinating was that the Center for Disease Control, according to the Washington Post in December, the CDC has been urging doctors to curb their opiate prescriptions because the risks of addiction and death are so high and the benefits of these drugs are unproven. Deaths from legal prescription drugs has surged 16.3% since 2002 to 18,000, close to 19,000 deaths per year. Heroin overdoses have climbed 28% to 10,574 per year. And the thing that just stood out for me in the article about the CDC was that the concern was that healthcare providers, primary care physicians primarily, wrote 259 million prescriptions for painkillers in 2012. And that was enough for every adult in the United States to have a bottle of pills. That's according to the CDC.
And I think the shocking thing there is that whilst pain has not increased significantly over the last 20 or so years, all of us Americans are levels of pain and how much pain there is hasn't increased hugely, that number of prescriptions written has gone up 4 times.
And then the final part of the CDC article, the director, Tom Frieden, said that prescribing patterns of these prescription meds is linked to fraudulent marketing of prescription opiates by drug companies. In 2007, there was a settlement with Purdue Pharma, and their 3 top executives pled guilty to misbranding OxyContin as less addictive than other narcotics and paid a $634 million fine, which clearly didn't drive them out of business, which I guess tells us how big a business this is.
I remember reading many years ago, Elizabeth, the front page of, it was either a Time or a Newsweek, and it was about the drug trade. And it said millions of users and billions of dollars. And I think it's the same today. The topic is frightening in many ways, is that just because an opiate comes in the form of a painkiller doesn't mean that it's not addictive. I think if you spoke to people and said, oh, you know, heroin or cocaine or methamphetamine, they'd say, well, those are bad things. They're drugs. You can get addicted. You can die. And people think that just because something comes from a doctor or from a pharmacy, it's okay. And that's definitely not the case. The active ingredient in OxyContin is exactly the same as the active ingredient in heroin. And unfortunately, people can become addicted and suffer terrible consequences.
And I think I read that the recommendation is really only 3 or 4 of these pills post-surgery. And anything past that would be considered...
I think it's very difficult to sort of talk averages and so forth. Each patient, each medical surgery or whatever is going to be very unique. And I think there are many, many doctors that do their best, but there are doctors who, either because they're unscrupulous or because they lack the knowledge and the education, don't really know what they're doing when it comes to prescribing opioids. I was talking to one of our doctors actually yesterday, our chief medical officer, and we have 15 doctors who operate in our clinics. And she was saying that if she knew back then what she now knows about addiction and opiates, when she was in primary care, she would have practiced very differently when it came to prescribing painkillers.
Well, and of course, that we know there has to be a problem when the CDC is writing, urging doctors, begging doctors basically to curb their use.
Yeah.
And just, you know, so people who might not be as familiar with the addictive properties of opiates. And I also, you know, for a lot of people who have been prescribed these pain medications and right now are feeling anxious or feeling triggered, like, oh, no, I've been taking OxyContin or Percocet and should I be concerned? Let's talk a little bit about the addictive properties and opiates and what they are for people who might not know. So opiates, and you're going to fill me in. From what I know, opiates are also referred to as narcotics, but I think opiates have become like a gentler way to call it. If we said, hey, I'm writing a prescription for a narcotic, you'd be a little more anxious about taking it, correct?
I think that's right.
So opiates, which are narcotics, are a group of drugs used to relieve pain, opium, morphine, heroin, codeine, OxyContin, Percocet, to name a few. And then there are synthetic versions of these opiates, which are methadone, which is quite often used in the treatment of addiction. And then collectively, all of these are called opiates.
That's correct.
Okay. And so how they work is that these drugs target the brain's reward system by flooding the circuit with dopamine, which is a neurotransmitter in the region of the brain that regulates movement, emotion, cognition, motivation, and feelings of pleasure, which is interesting because last week we talked about the region of the brain that controls thirst, hunger, and passionate love, and they're all intertwined, and that when we fall in love or we feel hungry, we get releases of dopamine to remind us to eat and to drink and to take care of our love life, so that they're survival mechanisms. So dopamine is critical in keeping us going. So these drugs target that area and overstimulates the system, which is naturally activated with natural rewards of behavior, and produces euphoric results. So it takes the dopamine, or it bypasses the dopamine, floods the system, and creates this euphoric feeling. And then addiction occurs because our brains are wired to ensure that we'll repeat life-sustaining activities by associating these activities with pleasure reward. If something tastes good, we're going to continue eating. And so that reminder of the brain, we got to keep eating because it not only feels good, but it's good for us. But what happens when you're taking these narcotics or the opiates, whenever that reward circuit is activated, the brain takes note and programs now the individual to continue that behavior over and over and over again. And so the opiates now flooding the system, the brain is overwhelmed with that pleasure and craves it over and over and over, causing the addiction.
And I think that's right, and very, very well put to a complex subject and complex neurobiology in the brain. And then I think what happens is the brain, that part of the brain, loses its natural ability to make its own sort of pleasure reward system and relies on the external drugs.
So when people try to come off of the drugs, right, if they're done with their prescription or feel like they want to stop using these drugs, then the brain can't create enough dopamine, right, to keep them stable.
And that results in them feeling sick or having, you know, if they are actually sort of fully addicted, then suffering withdrawal. So what happens is the brain says, I have to have more of these opiates, otherwise I'm going to feel sick. So what happens is the person no longer takes the drugs to feel high or euphoria. They take the drugs so as not to feel sick. And that is like you or I, as one of our clinical people puts it, that's like you or I going without water for a week.
Right.
We would do anything to, our brains would say, I have to have water to live. Similarly, somebody who's addicted to heroin or prescription painkillers, if they don't get their, in their eye, medicine, but the drug, then they'll feel terribly, terribly sick. And it's a disease.
And I would imagine then once the dopamine has been bypassed and the brain has now been adapted to the feelings of euphoria, that craving for the euphoria would overwhelm our ability to make conscious choices,
right? It overrides it hugely. And people will make choices irrespective of the consequences. And that can result in, you know, somebody doing anything to look for, to score drugs on the street. Because the other tragedy that happens, and you alluded to it, Elizabeth, when you said that 3 out of every 4 people who end up addicted to heroin started with prescription painkillers. If somebody starts with prescription painkillers, when they no longer are able to get those prescription painkillers, either because the doctor won't prescribe them anymore or their illegal source dries up, the brain is still saying, I need those. And heroin is very often where they go to get that relief.
Because $20 is cheap.
Heroin is cheap. Heroin is cheap, and it's widely available.
And so why, Alex, the increase in drug overdose, the death related to it? Because that also was stunning. There's a lot of people that have addictions to many things. But in this case with the opiates, it's the level of death associated to overdose.
I think that's a good question and important for viewers and everybody to know and understand. The rate of overdose has increased, but it hasn't increased. It's increased in proportion to the use of prescription painkillers and heroin. The reason somebody will overdose and die is one of the side effects, for want of a better word, of people seeking the euphoria or trying not to feel sick, is part of the brain will tell another part of the brain and ultimately the lungs and the heart to stop breathing. And people will pass into unconsciousness and die. That's how overdose, one of the ways that overdoses can result in death.
But I guess my question is, and I don't know if you know the answer to this, why these drugs? Is it because they shut the body down, so it puts you at a higher risk of overdose as opposed to cocaine or?
It's because the, in layman's terms, because of the pain-killing nature mm-hmm. of opiates, which are very, you know, we use them in medicine. They've saved, you know, millions of people lives and pain. It's because too much of it will close the body down.
If you're just tuning in, this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and my guest in the studio today is Alex Dodd. He is the CEO of Aegis Treatment Centers, located all over the state of California, with a high success rate in treating opiate and heroin addictions. And we'd like to invite you to be part of the conversation today, 805-781-3875. If you have a question or comment for Alex, we'd like to hear from you. And, you know, again, this isn't one of those cheery conversations, and I sent out a note, you know, to my family. I always remind them every week what the topic is for the show. So we're going to talk about opiate addictions, heroin addictions, because it's an epidemic, and it's rising. It's consistently rising every year to the point where the federal government has now put out at least $133 million in federal funds. You had a different number, but marked to combat addiction by increasing access to drug treatment and prevention programs. And, you know, I sent the message out, and my daughter immediately wrote back and said, that's a cheery topic. And I said, yeah, it maybe isn't the cheeriest. It's definitely not a Valentine's, you know, day theme, but we all love others. And for many of us, those we love may be struggling with addiction. Yeah. And I think when it comes to something of this level of addiction, I know that my life has been touched multiple times with opiate and heroin addiction in the last 10 years with close friends that I would have never expected, and that it's heartbreaking. And so if I, just this one person in this lovely county, have had such a firsthand experience, then others I know have people they love madly, yeah, who are struggling with addiction.
I think that's right. I think perhaps an ironic way, the encouraging thing is that at a federal level, and certainly within our state, there is absolute acceptance and recognition that we're in the middle of an epidemic. This is public health crisis number one. More people die of heroin and prescription painkiller overdoses than die in car crashes, which, if you think of how many cars there are on the roads of America, is kind of silly. And I think the other aspect is because it is now so prevalent, and with continuing education, there's less stigma associated with it. If you went back a generation, you know, the notion of somebody being in your family or a close friend or a work colleague suffering addiction, it was, oh, that's terrible. There's something wrong with them. Nowadays, you know, fortunately, unfortunately, it's much more prevalent, and everybody knows somebody who suffers from the disease of addiction, and often that is opioid addiction. But as the stigma is reduced, more and more people are aware of treatment. And the good news is that for this disease, there is treatment that works. You know, that's if somebody, a family friend or a work colleague or whoever you know is suffering from opioid addiction, or you think they may have a problem with heroin, there is something can be done about it.
And I think, and we're going to talk more about it this hour, from the mental health piece, is that if you love someone with an addiction issue, The hard, heartbreaking piece of it is that you can't love them enough to get them to stop. Is that all of the love in the world cannot help an addict?
Love is a necessary but not sufficient part of the equation to make them get better.
If you'd like to be part of the conversation, 805-781-3875. Robert, you're on the air with Alex. What's on your mind?
Yes, I just wanted to share an experience I had with a major injury, and as a result of that, the doctor prescribed me OxyContin and Vicodin, and just like you're talking about, I had a very difficult time getting off those drugs. And the one thing that ultimately was an exit drug for me and helped me get clean was medical cannabis. And I know there's controversy surrounding that. I just wanted to share my experience because, you know, I know a lot of people would still like to see it illegal. I think it should be fully legal because it ultimately helped me get clean. And just wanted to share that experience and let your listeners know that medical cannabis does, in fact, work.
Robert, thank you very much.
Thank you, Robert, for calling in.
Robert, thank you for that. And I can empathize that, you know, using the painkillers of OxyContin and I think you said Vicodin to help you recover from injury, you know, many people will find it difficult to wean themselves or titrate themselves off that. I don't think it's really for me to comment about medical marijuana, but the good news is in your particular case, medical marijuana worked. And it may well work in the case of other people who are finding it difficult to go back to leading their lives post-injury without using heavy painkillers.
And so let's talk about Aegis's treatment because you are the CEO, so I know your heart is connected deeply with the program. Can you talk a little bit about the model of care that Aegis offers? And to let people know also that we do have centers in Santa Maria and
Santa Barbara and Atascadero,
yes,
at least as far as the Central Coast is concerned.
And I have to tell you that before I met you, Alex, I had no idea that these centers existed and had worked in, you know, mental health industry for 20-something years here on the Central Coast. And one of the things that we would hear over and over again in the profession locally was there was no treatment for addicts. We had no place for people to go. Yeah.
Well, one of the things we sometimes say to ourselves as colleagues and to other medical providers who provide similar services to us because we're all in the greater fight against addiction is that many of our treatment centers are the best kept secrets, which is ironic. But as addiction is becoming more and more accepted and less hit by stigma and treatment becoming more and more part of mainstream healthcare with the Affordable Care Act, covered California, and insurance companies now covering treatment, we're able to come out of the, you know, the sort of out of the back alleys and the dark areas into mainstream medical facilities. So I think the easiest way to describe the treatment is that it is medically supervised. I think that's very important for everybody to know. It's heavily regulated and licensed at a federal and a state level, medically supervised by a licensed doctor. And the treatment consists really of two things. One is counseling and therapy of both an individual nature and a group therapy, really to help the patient gain the commitment, skills, and confidence to lead a drug-free life. If somebody has become dependent on opiates, then for them to give that up is huge. It's very, very, very difficult. Again, it's like you or I going without water for a week. It's
right.
Very difficult. So,
and it can be, it's physically addictive also, right? So there's a physical danger.
It is neurobiologically, physically addictive.
Right. So you can't just really
stop.
You can't
just stop. And, you know, whether it was Nancy Reagan or whoever who coined the phrase, just say no. Unfortunately, it doesn't work like that. So the treatment consists of counseling and therapy on one side. But for the body and the brain and the patient to be able to benefit from that counseling and therapy, they need to not be in physical withdrawal. And that's where the use of medication comes in. And the medication is typically one of two medicines, either buprenorphine or methadone. And they help the patient not be in withdrawal and be sick, lead a normal life, go to work, have relationships, lead a family life, whilst they can, you know, work on the therapeutic side of learning to lead a drug-free life.
So Aegis is outpatient.
We are all outpatient. There are inpatient programs, and both have their place in the treatment of opioid addiction.
And so I think, and when I, again, doing the research and talking to people, that the idea of the methadone, using that makes people concerned that you're almost trading one addiction to another, that replacement therapy. How does that work? And is the goal to not be using it all at some point?
Very much so, especially with younger and younger patients who unfortunately are you know, one of the groups that is suffering these days. With all our patients, we very much want them to have the goal of being drug-free and medicine-free. It's a bit like if I suffered from high cholesterol or high blood pressure or diabetes, and I was taking a medicine for that, the doctor could say to me, oh, you know, keep taking these pills for the rest of your life, and it doesn't matter whether you eat bad food and don't exercise. You know, I could live my life like that, but I'd rather say, hang on a second, if I get my diet and exercise under control, maybe one day I won't need the medicine. And the analogy is exactly the same with addiction. If somebody is able to learn new skills and confidence to lead a drug-free life, then they can lead a medicine-free life as well, and they don't need the medication of either the buprenorphine or the methadone.
And so for people that enter into treatment, that's like I read there was a holistic, a multi-dimensional holistic treatment that is the medical care, counseling and therapy, some social work and support groups for ongoing care long after the original treatment is done. And so it seems like that maintenance, that support of being with other people who have struggled or are trying to maintain a drug-free life would be really important.
I think it is. And although it's not exactly the same, the sort of 12 steps, or I think ours are 15 steps model, you know, the whole Alcoholics Anonymous piece of 12 steps and a community of support, I think is very valid. And many of our recovering patients, whether they're in treatment or out of treatment, rely on that community and to help them afterwards, because it's like alcoholism, it's a lifelong disease that you have under control. There's no such thing as being able to say, well, I used to be an alcoholic. Well, no, you're an alcoholic. You're just in recovery. You can't say, I used to be a heroin addict. You know, you are a heroin addict right now. Thankfully, you're in recovery.
And is that because if you were to return, let's say you had another injury and you were prescribed OxyContin, that your body would more quickly become addicted to it because you have a history of addiction?
Yes, I think that's right. It's very complex at a neurobiological level, and the science is still being discovered.
This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and my guest today is Alex Dodd from Aegis Treatment Centers, and we're talking about the epidemic of opiate addiction, heroin addiction, and the importance of having this conversation in our communities, because I think there is this fantasy that we live in a bubble that isn't touched by things like drug addiction, especially something that we consider dark alley like heroin addiction. But I think all of us are starting to realize more and more, and we probably don't have dinner conversations or cocktail party conversations about people in our lives who might be struggling with opiate addictions from prescription medications, because it's a quiet shame that no one wants to talk about. And the thing that's so difficult is because these addictions quite often start in the doctor's office, and we're taught to trust the doctors who are to have our best interests and our health at heart. And I don't want to make this also a bashing of doctors, because this addictive prescription level of opiates is not just doctors poorly prescribing, it's the information they're receiving from pharmaceuticals who have told doctors that they're safer than they actually are, that these narcotics can be used. And so we have kind of this trickle down of bad information from the pharmaceutical companies to doctors and to managed care primary, you know, private insurance that's going to pay for.
It's a very complex environment. And I think in addition to, at least historically, Elizabeth, doctors not have addiction being a very small part of the curriculum of a doctor's education. I think historically some doctors have said that, you know, they go to medical school for 5 or 7 years and they spend 2 weeks on addiction.
And then they've got even less on mental health.
And then they've got, you know, pharmaceuticals companies saying, oh, you know, these painkillers are not addictive. You know, so it's not surprising that prescribing practices are not in control. And then, you know, there is the unfortunate aspect of, you know, society at large, glorification of, you know, drug use, media. It's a very complex subject. But the good news, I come back to it, is, you know, for people who do suffer from dependency and addiction, it is a disease, and there are treatments that work. There is good news.
It's taking the steps to get the help, right? And that's the mental health piece, is helping people feel supported enough or safe enough to step up and get the help they need. 805-781-3875 is the number to be part of this conversation with a reluctant therapist. You're listening to Public Radio KCBX. And Harry, thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Yes. I just completed 6 months ago Dr. Kenneth Starr's recovery program. I was addicted to Vicodin for 14 years, starting with an injury at work. And Dr. Kenneth Starr is an emergency room doctor at Twin Cities Hospital. His recovery program is now in Arroyo Grande. He uses the most important thing is you physically have to get off of the cravings for the opiate. Mm-hmm. And the psychological part is secondary. How can you deal with the psychological part when you are still leg kicking? So he uses a chemical called NAD, and the proper name of that is nicotinamide adrenaline dinucleotide. He puts you on IV for 10 days, then gives you supplements to go home with. Dr. Kenneth Starr, I don't understand why you're not addressing the wonderful job he's doing right here in San Luis Obispo County.
Harry, thank you so much for calling in and talking about the program. It's not a program that I'm particularly aware of. We're not avoiding Dr. Starr's work at all. My guest today, Alex Dodd, is with Aegis Treatment Centers, which are located also locally. And we're just talking about the addiction from his perspective because of his expertise and also that he's associated with these treatment centers. But I think our message, or I don't know if you would agree, is that it doesn't really matter which road you take to recovery, yeah. Right?
Indeed. I think it's Harry, good English name, by the way. I think it's great that Dr. Kenneth Starr has been able to help you, and I'm sure has helped many, many other people. As Elizabeth said, people who are addicted to opiates, whether it's prescription painkillers or heroin, need all the help they can get. So whether it's from our company, Aegis Treatment Centers, or Dr. Kenneth Starr, it's just good news that there are people now able to help all of us who've suffered such things as you have. Thank you.
Well, and it is, I think the good news part is that we're hearing people's stories of recovery, because part of me thought we would get more calls of people concerned about their use and wanting some help with that. But to hear, you know, now two different stories of people who've had success through recovery, again, there are many roads to recovery, no matter what it is that we're dealing with, whether it's addiction or with mental health issues, depression, anxiety. There are many roads to getting there, whether it's medically based or therapeutically based.
And I think Harry touched on one aspect, which is very important, is it's both a physical and a psychological treatment. Whether it's with Dr. Scott Starr or anyone else,
Kenneth, you
need, as one of our doctors, Dr. Lasher, who is in our Central Valley clinics, puts it, medication is good, counseling is good. Medication and counseling together is the best.
Which we seem to find is the theme for many areas where people suffer. 805-781-3875. Barbara, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
I have an opinion about why so many people get hooked on prescription drugs.
Okay.
I think that it's directly related to the fact that it just doesn't work. It's just not possible to be sick or injured or not well in our culture. We still have to work through it. We have to go back to work after our surgery or after we've pulled a muscle in our back or any one of these, you know, types of injuries. Whereas if we were able to stay home, be able to nurse our wound, be able to heal and get some compassionate care, I think people would be able to deal with their pain. But to deal with the pain and have to work or produce, I think it's very difficult.
Barbara, thank you for that. I think you mentioned something interesting, which is the world has changed in that respect, which, you know, several years ago, as you say, we might have had more time or less pressure to immediately do something post an accident. Society these days does require us to get better quickly, and all of us as consumers want instant gratification and instant solutions to things. So I think that, together with doctors and the medical profession being under tremendous pressure to treat patients, The easiest thing for a doctor to do is if you go in there and say, you know, I fell over and I hurt my shoulder, the easiest thing for them to do is to say, here, let me write you a prescription. Instead of saying, well, why don't you go home, have a hot bath, massage it, take it easy, and come back next week.
Right, or it's going to take 6 months to recover.
Yeah.
That's right, and I think that would be very helpful. And I also think that I had chronic pain. Well, I still have chronic pain, but I had intense chronic pain for a long time. And it took me a while to make friends with my pain, because I think pain is a signal to the body that you've got to do something. You've got to, and you get very anxious that you have to do something to fix it. But sometimes that's not true. Sometimes you just have to learn how to live with pain, and I think that's where pain clinics sometimes are helpful. But it would be helpful if that surgeon, before the surgery, would give you a little talk about pain, and not to panic, or that pain didn't mean things did not go well, and we have to get rid of it.
I think that's an excellent suggestion.
Yeah, Barbara, thank you for the call. And it's interesting because it ties into the mental health piece, that we have people who don't like the discomfort, or they're told they should never feel uncomfortable, that depression and anxiety, you know, are sicknesses, when they are very much connected to our style of life or what's going on in our life, or situational, as is pain. If you get in an accident or you have surgery or, you know, you get hurt in some way, you're going to have pain for a period of time. And we are, you know, there you touched on a little bit, there is a bit of a cultural fear or unwillingness to sit with discomfort for any period of time. And so I think that can get us caught in this this trap, that we take the easy road and it ends up being the long, torturous exit.
That I think that's right. One related perhaps to what Barbara said, I think one thing for everybody to sort of also understand is addiction is often related to other mental health issues. Mm-hmm. I think as a field, we would estimate that between 70 and 80% of people who are treated for opioid addiction suffer from some co-occurring dual diagnosis mental disorder, whether that's a soldier returning from battle, you know, suffering from PTSD or TBI, or somebody who's clinically depressed, or somebody who's bipolar. There's often... sometimes addiction presents itself in isolation, but more often than not, it's in combination with something else. So I think the other good thing from a societal point of view, Elizabeth, is that addiction and addiction treatment with the Affordable Care Act is being increasingly seen as part of mainstream healthcare. Insurance companies are now obliged to cover it as one of the essential benefits, and companies like us are increasingly contracted with insurance companies. So if there are any listeners out there who are wondering whether their insurance company covers addiction treatment for them or a family member, the answer is it should. And if it isn't, then contact your local politician and kick up a big fuss.
So is there privacy with that? I think a lot of people are concerned about tapping into their...
Some people are. We have a few situations where we have patients who they know that their insurance company will cover addiction the cost of their addiction treatment. But they don't want to use their insurance because they're a little fearful that it'll come out in the workplace or in a family environment.
So but we I think still have some stigma with
stigma.
It.
The stigma will be there for a long time to come, but it's every day it's getting a little bit less.
And I think, again, that's the dance I do as a clinician, because I want to talk about this cultural concern of not being able to tolerate pain or discomfort, right? Because that is an issue that has changed, that we have been told by the media and by culture and by doctors and by big pharma that you should never be uncomfortable. And so we have to really think about or reinvestigate what is tolerable when it comes to pain or discomfort. How much should we be able to handle? Because on the same hand, I also don't want people to feel like if they do have an addiction or they are suffering from chronic depression or anxiety, that they are somehow weak and shouldn't talk about it because I'm just giving in to the pain. You know, so there's this dance we do of wanting those who really need help to seek the help, and wanting to help educate those who tend to overseek help, right, to know that they don't need to constantly be reassured. And that is something that happens on the spectrum of mental health and in physical care, that individuals quite often fall on one end of the spectrum or the other. Those who really need help tend to avoid it, like the plague, and those who really don't need help and could do fine on their own tend to overseek. And if you're just tuning in, this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. My guest is Alex Dodd, CEO of the Aegis Treatment Centers. We're talking about the epidemic of opiate addictions. Opiates are narcotics in the same group of drugs used to relieve pain, like opium, morphine, heroin, OxyContin, Percocet. And 3 out of 4 times those who end up with a heroin addiction began with these legal prescriptions to these opiate drugs. And the thing that I talked about when I introduced the show on my Facebook page was a statistic that really concerned me, that young adults, 12 to 17, are the fastest growing group of abusers of these prescriptions. And they're not getting them because they're being prescribed these medications. They're actually finding them in the medicine cabinets of friends and family. And they perceive, the young people perceive, that these drugs are safer than the street drugs because they are prescriptions that are being written. And so that is a whole nother level of this issue, is that how do we protect our children when they are not getting, they're not being written prescriptions, but they have a fantasy or perception that it's safe.
If I can, Elizabeth, mm-hmm. on that, I think there are three ways to do that. And I think that may well be in the minds of people who are listening. I think the first one is make sure you lock up your prescriptions. If mm-hmm. you, as an adult, have a pain prescription or any prescription, don't leave it in the bathroom cupboard.
Just like you wouldn't leave your gun in the cupboard.
Just like you wouldn't leave your gun in the cupboard. It's a good analogy. Lock it up. The second thing is educate your kids. Mm-hmm. I have a 12-year-old daughter, and not every day, but drugs. I mean, she knows what I do for a living. So compared to other 12-year-olds, she's probably more exposed to it. But I talk openly. We talk openly with her about the dangers of addiction. And she'll say, how does heroin work on the brain? And I have to try and explain that. It's difficult enough to explain it to myself, but I have to explain it to a 12-year-old. So I think educate your kids, and then make sure in a school environment that the school takes responsibility for educating students.
And for me, number 4 would be talk about the ability to sit with discomfort, because that has to start with conversations we have with our children. And if we as adults don't like to feel uncomfortable or don't want to feel pain or don't want to feel anxious, then we're going to pass that down to our children and set them up also for the danger of addictions. 805-781-3875. Hi, Rod, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Yeah, hi. As I was waiting, you guys actually addressed almost all my concerns.
Oh, good.
My questions basically were, I'm really a little naive in this area and just surprised at what an epidemic it is. I wouldn't even know what somebody looked like if they were on heroin. I don't know if they can function very well.
Rod, they'd look like you or me.
Are teenagers currently doing that? Like, for instance, in this county, are teenagers getting a hold of that stuff and are they using it? And then my other question, which you guys kind of addressed, was what are the preventive measures out there that a parent can use to try and curb that from ever occurring?
So how old are your children, Rod?
They are 12 and 14.
And so you're right in that kind of danger area, right, of 12 to 17-year-olds who have a lot of curiosity and not a lot of experience.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? And they learn a lot about what's happening in the world from their peers. And the thing that's so frightening about heroin and opiate addiction, and Alex actually said it while you were talking, that it's, you don't really see the telltale signs, you know, ahead of time, right? Because when someone...
That's right. I mean, you asked... Rod, what a person who suffers from this disease would look like.
Yeah,
you may see them down and out, and track marks on their arms, and suffering from hepatitis C, but they may look just like you or me or Elizabeth, mm-hmm. and no one would know the difference. It's a very insidious disease. But to come back to what you can do, I think as far as children are concerned, it's almost like it's never too young to talk to them about it. I mean, you would talk to an 8-year-old about how to cross a road safely.
Yep, exactly.
Why wouldn't you talk to an 8-year-old about, you know, you'd talk to an 8-year-old about don't get into a car with strangers, don't accept sweeties from a stranger. You'd talk to an 8-year-old, you know, just don't mess with, you know, be careful if mommy or daddy has medicine, that's for them. It's not for you.
And again, that's always, Rod, my concern from the mental health perspective is if our children need to take an antibiotic or, right, take a prescription drug of some kind, and then we're saying, but don't take other prescription drugs, right? If your friends show up at school with some, don't take them, but you need to take these, that we're sending very confusing messages to children. Uh-huh. And I think that as parents, for parents, can be alarming, right? Uh-huh. And also because a lot of children, I mean, we could bump this conversation up a lot if we want to talk about the amount of teenagers that are selling their ADHD prescriptions to their friends, yeah. Right?
Oh.
So there's a lot of areas to be concerned.
Yeah. I think one other one, Rod, and, you know, as I mentioned, you know, we have a daughter who's 12. You have a child who's 12 and 14. I think the other thing is that schools and parents, the trap they fall into is believing that if their child, and I'm not a child psychologist or an expert, I'm a parent, but this is my addiction is my field, is if they see a child, you know, experimenting with drugs, not doing well in school, that could be related to drugs, or hanging out with people who may be using drugs, very often a parent themselves will be afraid or ignorant, and they'll say, "Ah, it's only a phase the kid's going through. You know, Johnny or Mary will grow out of it." And, you know, maybe more often than not, they will. But they won't always grow out of it.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, some people are genetically more disposed than others to suffer addiction. And I don't, you know, why take the risk?
I agree. Rod, thank you for the call.
Can I ask one more thing real quick?
Yes.
So, like, currently, teenage parties, are they getting together and using heroin like recreationally?
Well, yes and no. I mean, whether there are teenage parties where people will go and solely use heroin, I don't know. I would imagine yes, but certainly...
Well, so there, one of the concerns that we see with teenagers is that they have prescription parties and that they bring prescription drugs from their parents' homes and throw them into a bowl and they just take them. So that is I mean, I don't want to horrify you, but it's
it
important. It does happen. Yeah. And that is something that's going on because, again, the kids don't equate these prescription drugs with street drugs. They think they're okay. And again, so many of our children are being prescribed medications at young ages that they're growing up. You know, the whole just say no culture really is fairly laughable because the dare to stay off is a little bit laughable because so many children are being raised on prescription meds. How do they discern?
So
that party is one thing. And heroin use is so prevalent. It's also on college campuses and is being used recreationally on college campuses and high schools as well. So, yes, it is an epidemic that we should be concerned about. But because it's so frightening, we're afraid to have the conversation. And so the best thing I can say to you, Rod, is be in your kids' lives. Yeah. Know their friends. Yep. Know the friends' parents. Don't be afraid to be the uncool parent that shows up at the party uninvited. Because you have nothing to lose. My proudest moment was every time one of my daughters looked to me and said, "Oh, my gosh, Mom, you're the only mom that would do this." And I go, "Good."
Yeah.
I'm proud. Thanks for calling, Rod.
Okay, thanks a lot.
I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. My guest today is Alex Dodd. We're talking about the epidemic of opiate addiction. And Charlie, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Hey, Charlie Blay, as a retired surgeon, one of my mentors, encourage people to use enough pain medication, particularly in the hospital, to be able to move comfortably, but not take the pain away. Also, I think perhaps the suggestion to my medical friends is use things like Tylenol with codeine or non-steroidal anti-inflammatory can sometimes help with the pain, and they don't need to go to the more expensive higher class drugs. But anyway, I think you might say, because I think these are so heavily advertised, people tend to go to the big guns before they need to.
Absolutely. Thank you, Charlie. And it is true, and a caller who did want to go on the air said, you know, if the pharmaceutical companies are misbranding these medications. And we talked at the top of the show that in 2007, Purdue Pharmaceuticals paid $634 million after pleading guilty to misbranding OxyContin as less addictive than other narcotics. You know, shouldn't these drug companies be held responsible for the treatment, for the money into treatment centers, to educating doctors, to providing the education? Because, you know, the opiates are one class of drugs that are being pushed by pharmaceuticals, and they really are just a modern-day version of drug pushers. I don't know. 805-781-3875. Becky, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Hi. I'm so glad you're talking about this topic. I have had to deal with medications myself, and there's a particular one, you know, I was told that was was not addictive like an opiate, and it was an opioid, and it's called tramadol. I never see that in any articles or hear it brought up, but I know many people that have been prescribed this medication. I think it's important for them to know. Also, another major addiction problem is benzodiazepines, like Xanax and things like that, which often are prescribed to the same people. I was first given it as anti-nausea medicine through cancer treatments and wasn't told that it was a tranquilizer. So I just wanted to add those. And people can get off of them. I happened to find a place that helped me taper very gradually off of things, and it was tough, but just by tiny amounts I was able to do it. So people don't give up.
Becky, thank you so much.
Becky, it's thank you very much for raising the question of opioid versus opiate. I think it's one of the areas that the field can make things less confusing for people. There's a technical difference between an opiate and an opioid. And without spending too long on it, opiates are opioids, but opioids are not opiates. But to all intents and purposes, they're one and the same thing. So when you hear opiate or opioid, think the same thing. They're all highly addictive. And depending on the individual's disposition and genetics and other things, they could become dependent on them. Tramadol, as an opioid, is as addictive as OxyContin or heroin. As I was saying to Elizabeth, I think before we went on the air, the active ingredient in all of them is exactly the same and has the same effect on the brain. You raise a good point about everyone needing to clarify and not get confused between opiates and opioids.
And of course, the takeaway I keep coming up with as we talk is that as consumers or as patients, we have to be vigilant in understanding everything that's being prescribed, asked of us, given to us. We know that we should always have an advocate or ally with us when we go in for any sort of medical procedure or appointment to get two ears on the conversation and to not trust. And again, I love my medical professional friends because they all come to this work with the biggest of hearts, but they're limited in their education about every single possible way people can
just because heal. Somebody has a degree in medicine and wears a white coat doesn't mean they're an expert in all things medical. It's a very complex.
And it's not that they're malicious either.
No, it's a very complex subject. Just if I may, Elizabeth, Becky mentioned benzodiazepines.
Yes.
That's a very important thing to mention. And I think something else for everyone to watch out for. Either for themselves or for, you know, loved ones and friends and family and work colleagues, is medicines generally do not go well together. You shouldn't mix different medicines. If somebody is being prescribed a benzodiazepine for something, that's generally not going to go well with a painkiller. And a number of patients we see in our outpatient treatment clinics are also using or addicted to benzodiazepines as well as opiates, and it's a lethal combination.
So we don't just have one thing, but there can be a multiple or buildup of them. Bruce, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Yes, I crushed my thumb years ago, and to the point where the doctor thought I might lose it. So as you know, your hands, they have a lot of nerves in them, so there's a lot of pain. So I got prescribed Vicodin, and about the third day of taking Vicodin, the only really way I can describe it is I felt like Keith Richards looks, and that's just the way I felt. I felt creepy. Mm-hmm. I felt yucky. And so in 3 days, then I quit. And it, it was scary because I had to sleep at night, and I had crushed my thumb, and I didn't know if I could. So I'm sitting here thinking, I've got two choices. Either I'm going to quit taking this stuff, and I'm going to have some, like you said, the pain, being uncomfortable. I had to be uncomfortable for about a week. Mm-hmm. I went to Tylenol. I just went to Tylenol, and I lived through it, and I was fine, but I just felt myself going down a road that I didn't know if I could get off of. So I just had to make that tough choice and quit. I just threw the Vicodin away.
Well, and Bruce, I think that you speak of a common experience that a lot of people have, and you had the strength and wherewithal to know it was coming and to back away. But I think for a lot of people, it trips that center. Thank you for calling, Bruce. It trips that center, and it's difficult to pull ourselves back. 805-781-3875. As we wrap up our show today, Patrick, I think you're going to get the last word on it.
Oh, thank you.
What's on your mind today?
Hi there. I'm a recovered heroin addict and methadone addict, and I just wanted to mention that in terms of education against heroin addiction, there's two opposing sides of heroin. One is the absolute bliss of someone, and you know, I don't want to promote heroin, but the fact is the reason people, once they try it, go back to it is not because they're instantly addicted. It's because it feels really good and seems to solve all their problems. Like their problems just seem to float away. Like they whatever psychological thing, you know, hangs them up, it's gone, you know. So they're going to use it again and again. And what has to be addressed before anyone ever tries it, because no one should ever try it, and is that it leads to a suspension of the effect of endorphins and withdrawal. Mm-hmm. And I think that if in school people just, notwithstanding the stigma of even mentioning it in school, you know, it's got to be that stigma's got to be overcome so that people are educated as to what really physiologically happens to the human body when exposed to opiates.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And I think people just don't understand that. Kids definitely don't, you know. So, and they get overtaken by that, the bliss, or, you know, whatever you want to call it, of, you know, there's a name that's always used.
They call it euphoria. Thank you, Patrick. That's euphoria is that he's referring to, that it overrides the dopamine in the brain. It overstimulates what's naturally occurring in the body that's supposed to feel good and remind us to eat and drink and have sex and the things that are good about life. But the use of heroin overwhelms that dopamine center, and that the body starts to crave that hit over and over again. And I think Patrick's point is well taken, that it's scary to even say the word heroin out loud. And I can't imagine standing in front of a room of elementary school teachers and how the school district or parents would feel about an honest conversation with elementary school kids about heroin.
Well, the good news is that more and more school teachers and parents are having that conversation.
We're trying. And Alex Dodd, thank you so much for taking the time to come in and talk to us today. Alex is the CEO of Aegis Treatment Centers. Information, I assume, is online.
Online, aegistreatmentcenters.com. We have clinics in Atascadero, Santa Maria, and Santa Barbara, and elsewhere in the state, and partner with major insurance companies and San Luis Obispo County and the California Department of Healthcare Services.
It's spelled AEGIS, Aegis Treatment Centers. As always, I appreciate our listeners taking the time to call in and share their thoughts. We'll be back again next Tuesday at the same time. Until then, Alex Dodd, thank you for being part of the conversation. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is The Reluctant Therapist. Thank you for supporting Public Radio, KCBX.